Hi, guys. Hi. Sorry we're interrupting you during lunch. I don't know what kind of event organizer would put a talk during lunchtime, but you know, we're still going to bother you. Wanted to keep it relatively casual because we have a pretty long session here, right? 90 minutes. So we're going to do a quick round of intros. All friends here. Work together a lot, huh? Yep. And Alexi is actually my partner as well, so. I'll start with myself, and then I'll hand over to each of our panelists. But you know, I want to keep this a little bit more interactive, given the length, and you know, beyond just investing and funding, which I'm sure is a big topic in your mind in general. We're happy to answer any kind of advice or question you may have. You know, Rise and I especially have been advising for many years now, right? In this space, so very happy to share any thoughts or questions you may have. We may actually ask you some questions as well. To see what you're interested in, so we can gear our topics toward that as well. So my name is Jay. I don't think a lot of you here know me. I can't really recognize a lot of faces, but interesting. I don't know if you know a company called McKinsey. Interestingly, actually, Rise came from McKinsey too, a long time ago. We're one of a major consulting advisory firm. They didn't have a gaming practice back then when Rise was there.
No.
And I joined about 2005, you know, back in, it was almost 13, 14 years ago, and went and built a gaming practice for McKinsey and have been an advisor in this space, you know, advising anywhere from large, you know, multi-country, multi-billion dollar, you know, corporate clients to actually small developers, a lot of them actually based in Seattle as well. Very passionate, lifelong gamer, you know, always think about gaming, you know, I think Rice would know that I spent a lot of time thinking about the industry and the health of the industry. And trends in industry, and that's what I do as a living, for a living. Recently, if you have heard of Makers Fund, you know, about 2 years ago or 18 months ago, decided that I want to actually do a little bit more for the industry rather than just be an advisor. I would like to be more of a principal as well. Managed to leverage some of my connections back when I was at McKinsey to actually put together Makers Fund, which is an interactive entertainment-focused fund that invest in equity, right? And we're going to talk a little bit about equity versus project. And so far, I think, you know, in Knockwood and all that, lucky us, you know, and you know, fortunate to be in this position, I think we are one of the largest interactive entertainment-focused fund currently in the world. So that's good. We're trying to, you know, be responsible for it and really help the industry while we can, right? So that's my background. I will actually shift to Alexi a little bit, you know, because, you know, we also have a sister fund called Kowloon. We're not trying to toot our own horns here, but why don't, Alexi, you want to talk a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I can introduce myself. So I'm Alexi. With Jay, I co-founded Kowloon Nights, which is a project funding fund. We started in October last year. We haven't publicly announced very much, but I think it's coming up in the next few weeks. I've been in the industry for about 10 years now. I started at Ubisoft in Europe. They moved to Montreal to work at a big studio there, and then Rise actually brought me to the U.S. Good or bad, I don't know, but he brought me.
I think generally
so I worked for Rise at Xbox for a few years. I was and with Chris, who was here earlier. I helped with Rise and Chris build ID. Worked on a number of independent titles there, and then spent a couple years at Tencent also after that, splitting my time between the U.S. and China, helping build WeGame and a bunch of other things, and then for a while, Jay and I had been talking about doing something together. We've been good friends. I admire him very much, and we've decided that there's something that was missing in the industry, which is a team that's dedicated to really just fund projects. We think that the function of publishing and investing don't have always to be coupled. I think for a historical reason, they always have been together. But I think the industry has changed a lot over the past few years, and we're seeing more and more teams who may want to self-publish and are just looking for funding. And so we've kind of started building this fund together and came to life in October, and yeah, we'll be communicating more in the next few weeks.
Before, how many of you have heard of Kowloon Nights in this room?
Oh, good.
That's not bad.
That's really crazy. That's good.
Awesome. Now you leave here having heard of it now. It's going to be 100% by the end. Yeah. All right, Ilya, why don't you, you know, explain?
Okay, several words about me. I'm not from like consulting business or from a big US company. I start making games like in 2000 from the board games, and create the biggest publisher of board games in Russia and ex-US countries. After it, I work also with Ubisoft on Heroes of Might and Magic 5, franchise and develop game. And like 7 years ago, come to mail.ru, it's the biggest internet company in Russia. We make not only games, we also like social networks, like Tencent in China, mail.ru, the same company in Russia. And like a year ago, we decided to dedicate like $100 million to our corporate venture fund to invest in video games company in different stages, starting from seed up to consolidate 100% of the business. We already make several like good deals about games. We acquire Pixonic. It's one of the biggest Russian independent mobile developer. They develop War Robots. It's one of our successful titles at this moment. We acquire another studio like Beat Games. It's also based in Russia. They develop very good RPG. And we make a lot of other investments. We doesn't announce it because I prefer to announce the deal after we achieve some numbers in the studio. If the studio achieve like 10 or 20 million annual revenue, after it, we prefer to announce the deal. Before it, we prefer to invest money. In our philosophy, we invest not only money, but access to all our technologies, like analytic tools, server technology, client technology, and a lot of stuff. We don't want to merge all companies in one big group. We provide a lot of possibilities for developers to be, I don't know, to create separate like Zynga, Glue, or in any other companies in mail.ru group families. And in this case, we provide like money, technologies, marketing support, access to outsource in Russia or like in Eastern Europe with the good prices. And yes, now we have like more than 20 studios in portfolio and plan to continue invest a lot in companies in different parts of the world. Europe, US, it doesn't matter, because gaming industry is totally international in our opinion, and we mostly operate games worldwide on all platforms like PC, console, mobile, mostly free-to-play, frankly, not premium titles. But premium titles, we also launch first of our game in next month, and it's also interesting for us.
Okay, cool. Did they get an intro from you already earlier, or do you want to talk a little bit more?
Really, I didn't like formally talk because I try to avoid talking.
Come on. Give us the real deal.
Second bite at the apple. So I'm sorry, guys, you get to hear from me again. My name is Raj Deekal, and I've been in the industry about 15 years. And before the industry, I was at a consulting practice known as McKinsey, which Jay mentioned. I didn't just work in video games there. I didn't do any work in video games there, but I did a broad section of stuff from pharma to retail to finance. And it taught me a lot about business. I really enjoyed my time, and I enjoyed being an advisor to companies. They were always large companies. And I think when I got into the video game space, I started with Xbox and doing large parts of biz dev for Microsoft Studios, and I dealt with a lot of developers. It was my job to get to know all the developers in the world and take them out to dinner and schmooze them and make sure that they knew me, and if they wanted to make a game, they would pitch my team. And, you know, Alexei was like my right-hand guy. He was like a critical guy, did a ton of work for Xbox. It was really fruitful. But, you know, in the course of talking to developers, they would tell me about their business and their problems, and I was always thinking, you know, like, where's all the good advice? Like, who gives you guys advice about what to do? And so it was always something that I wish I could take my publisher cap off and all my associated interests as a publisher and just give them some real truth and some real advice. And so one day, you know, everything kind of just came together for me. And about 3 years ago, I left Microsoft and I started Strategic Alternatives, which is my current strategy consulting and acquisition advisory practice. And we have about 20 clients around the world, my partner Bob Wallace and I. Bob's been doing this longer than me. He's been doing it for about 20 years, all in retirement. And it's been great, you know, because for the first time, I'm really unfettered. I don't have a fixed interest. And even if they're not clients, I get to talk to lots of developers, hear their business problems, and it's interesting, right? When you hear it all, and you're in that flow of all everybody's problems, they bucket into very similar problems. So once you start advising them, it becomes kind of easier and easier to try to understand and diagnose everybody's issues. So I enjoy the work, and we help with investments and acquisitions, of course. So I'm happy to be on the panel with these guys today. They're some of the best, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, so much McKinsey talks here, you know. Issues, put the issues in buckets and all that.
It's so true. Structure the problem.
And all, like in some of the buckets, I like that. Before we actually start, you know, and please feel free to continue to eat. I'm just curious of the audience sort of mix, right? Maybe I'll throw a couple of questions and, you know, raise your hands if you're one of them. How many of you are developers here? Pretty much quite a lot. And some of you guys are not developer. Is there any that are a publisher role? Oh, there's actually some publishers. Nice. Awesome. Yeah? And what about like not a publisher and not a developer?
Oh, interesting.
Interesting. What are you doing, by the way?
He's an investor.
Oh, he's an investor. Okay.
Do we have another chair?
We're about to pull some. Oh, yeah, there are some. Okay, okay. Yeah. Are there any company that service developers here? Tools? Oh, there are some. Okay, interesting.
Good.
Interesting.
What about platform?
Yeah, so mobile-focused, PC-focused? PC-focused.
Okay.
Mobile-focused.
Interesting.
This is a lot. What VR?
Yeah.
AR?
VR? What? What are the rest of you
what
guys
are the
doing?
Rest of you guys doing? Oh, console focused. Nah, it's the same as PC almost.
Yeah.
Oh,
wow, okay. The things. Reaction to that.
Oh, look at this. Oh, do we have PlayStation and Xbox here?
I guess.
Yeah, you know.
Wow.
There are some people who didn't raise their hands, so I'm curious, like, is it not PC? Not PC and not mobile. See, that's the thing. So we have a little bit more PC developers than mobile, right? Almost half and half, though. Okay, let me another question. How many of you are self-funded if you're making a game? Holy moly.
Amen.
Wow. Right. How many of you are a publisher or someone else funded?
There's a few.
Okay, there's a few. How many of you are making your first game? A couple. More than your first game. People are eating.
It's kind of a split.
Yeah, kind of a split here. I've got a couple more questions. Yeah. How many of you have studios under 10 people?
That's most of you.
Okay, wow. Well, studio over 10 people. Can you raise your hand just to see if it's... Okay. Interesting.
As usual, you're sitting in the back.
How many of you makes a game working with a larger studio, like an outsourcer or, you know, other people's IP? Like, not your own game. Are there a couple? How many of you are working on your own game and your own IP?
You're all right.
Okay, very
good.
Cool. Very cool. Well, interesting. How many of you kind of wonder on the day-to-day basis, how do I ever, like, get funding out of this, you know, self-funded cycle? Yeah, it's quite a lot of them. Terrific, great. Okay, so we could probably cater our talk a little bit, you know. I actually want to start with Alexei a little bit, if you don't mind, right? You know, you how many developers have you talked to in the last, like, 12 months?
I think since we started the fund, 360.
360 developers.
That's again, not being publicly announced. So it's mostly our network of friends and then friends of friends. I think one of the things that we really try to do is, one, have a really quick process. If we find a project that we're interested in, we signal it very quickly. I think we have a timeline of about 2 weeks to say yes or no for everything.
Yeah.
But also a lot of developers that actually we ended up not signing.
Yeah.
Were really gracious and introduced their friends. Typically when we travel to a city, we would go see a few developers that we know already, and they will say, oh, you know what, there's all those guys you should see while you're in town. And so a trip to Montreal for 2 days ends up staying 15 days because there's just a lot of people to see. So we're...
I'm going to skip to the tougher question now because I think it's more relevant. So I know we only signed like roughly 9 games out of 360, right? You know,
that's correct.
So like for the 351 that we didn't sign, like what kind of advice would you give to people who have a game who's trying to get a publisher sign or get funding, but you know, what are places that they should try and approach, right, to get it going, you know?
You know, it's a tough question because I would say the vast majority of the things we see are good. I think that's the hardest thing for us is because there are things that we passed on, and that's probably the majority of games, were actually really competent, quite fun, interesting, we like the team, but then we have to rank what resonates with us the most, and so I think it's just, you have to take as many shots as you can.
Okay.
You never know which publisher, which partner is going to find something that they particularly enjoy or they believe in, And so I think trying as many avenues as we can, as you can is probably best. And you just get better at pitching over time.
Yeah.
I know it's a very grueling process. On our end, we try to make it as easy as we possibly can, but we know it's a really difficult thing. And you know, it's heartbreaking. Every email I have to write saying we're unable to fund is just difficult.
Yeah. What about you, Elia? How do you have you worked with many smart developers in the West so far?
And yes, we've worked with also with Western developers or like Eastern developers. We started like a year ago also, and I don't know, we have close to 1,000 companies in this moment in pipeline and try to talk with them. Of course, the biggest issue is in communications, to understand what developers want really. For most of developers, the biggest issue, they want to develop the game or develop the business. It's like two different way of the operations. And of course, for us, it's more interesting the company which you want to create something in business, not only in game industry. Because if you want to create on the game, you need to go to the publisher and find like a good publisher for your title. But if you want to like raise money from like in equity or project financing, you need to understand for what you spend this money and how you return this money to investors. And for most of developers in different regions, it's the same issues. Like in Russia, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, US, the question is how to create a business model. It's a big issue. And regular start discussion about show for us not only development plans, but show for us like some documents about how you plan to return the money, how you plan to work with your audience. No, like you talk a lot about like how you protect the franchise, because we're an equity investor, and for us it's very important. If we invest in company, we want to push this company to own the IPs, like developers and a lot of other stuff.
Do you invest in equity or project?
Equity.
Equity, right? Yes. Okay. I think we'll spend a little time. Why don't we give it to you? Like for the audience here who are not like as deep into equity versus project financing. Right. Any thoughts around that? Because you must have advised a lot of studios around like taking project versus equity financing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think in an ideal world, it would be great if there was more project financing. I think there are relatively few places to go where you can get project financing that doesn't come from a publisher. You know, and the thing about project financing is that it's not trying to take your equity, right, in the business. It's of course, compared to equity financing, right? Which is trying to get a piece of your business and everything that you make with it. You know, project financing, it stands on the merits of what vision you have and what thing that you want to make next.
I think that
would be great if there were just more places that you could take it.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad that you made Kowloon Knights.
Yeah.
I think hopefully it can prove a model and we can create more out there, more
Absolutely.
Alternatives for developers. And so everyone will have more places to go. I wish it was a more developed funding system like in Hollywood. And I think that's kind of the
what
vision that you
do.
Had with
yeah.
what you're trying to do with
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually have a lot of thoughts around this topic, but yeah, I'm the moderator, so I'm not going to shut up for now.
It's okay, you can say something. I mean, why don't you say something about equity versus project?
Yeah.
That would be great.
Quick question, has anyone in this room, first of all, has anyone in this room thought about project financing? Right? There are a couple. Project financing, taking money for your project, for your game, maybe they're about 6, 7. Has any of you thought about taking equity financing in this room? Actually, there are a couple, actually not as much, you know. For the rest that haven't raised your hand, is it because you already have money for your own game? Yes or no? Or you just didn't have any financial constraints and have enough money in the bank?
We should talk to you.
I know. You should be my sugar daddy. So I'll talk a little bit in the world of a developer. And a lot of time when a developer first go out and try and make a game, of course, you know, Kickstarter is always sort of an option, but you know what? It's getting so difficult nowadays, right? And that question came up. Kickstarter is more and more used for, you know, auxiliary boosting of funding, where, you know, you already have a main source of financing. You may want to close the gap on your target a little bit, and you go to Kickstarter to get a little bit of that. Pre-sales as well. Sometimes there's a lot of these pre-sales going on. But in general, if you need outside financing, you do have a couple of paths you can take. One path is what we call project financing. And project financing actually comes in usually in terms of the publisher. Until a couple of years ago, project financing is pretty much, you know, you're just signing with a publisher. And the publisher give you money to make the game. And typically when they give you money, they would take your IP. Now, interestingly, because of the rise of indie publisher, it actually there's actually a model in between where they give you financing, but they don't take the IP, which is actually quite a good thing in some ways for developers, because you keep your IP for the long run. But they do have a rev share model where, you know, they would probably take a good portion of your rev share, right, depending on how much they put up. So that's more a traditional model. Now, that model has been more standard because it comes with the publisher usually. Yeah. And it's also very game by game, right? You know, i.e., I don't need to get my house in order because I'm contractually working with you in a game, right? And I need to deliver the game. And if I deliver the game, you help me sell it, we share the revenue, right? It's a very contractual driven relationship. And that's why a discussion with the publisher, with your game, and even project financing sometime, it's sort of like a bit of a splitting the pie, right? You know, how much pie do you get versus I get, right? Although, of course, there's better way to split it, and there's also more, you know, not as good ways to split it, right? Now, equity financing comes in a different flavor. And for a lot of you who doesn't understand, you know, or may not have thought as much about equity financing, it actually mainly started, I don't know if the partial financing really started in the East more than the West. I don't know if you agree with me.
Hard to say.
It's hard to say though, huh? Was there a lot of like partial financing from the West though before?
Well, there was certainly venture. There's always
yeah, but
venture.
I'm talking about like from strategics, I guess.
From the strategics, yeah.
Well, but yeah, from the VC side. So equity financing is very much the, if you know Silicon Valley and how venture investing works, what happened is they decided that your company has good enough potential, right? Especially financial investor that can say, you know, someday you sell your company, I'm going to make money when you sell it. So they will give you money for a piece of your company. And there's no project financing on top of it, i.e. they don't really take anything from the game. Now, however, there are strategic equity financing that's in the mix a little bit, which you know, a lot of the Tencent or whatnot, and no audience has Tencent in it, where they would give you like some project equity financing. So there's no rev share on the game, but they may take your rights for the game in China, right? They may have first right of refusal for China, or a Korea gaming company may want to take the rights for Korea or whatnot. But that's also a path that more and more developers are exploring over the last few years. If you rewind like 10, 15 years though, I don't think that was the majority way of doing, you know, investing though.
Well, I think a lot of it matures as different distribution platforms were developed.
Yeah, exactly.
I think pre-mobile, when it was really just PC, and then when it was just console, I think it was different.
Yes, right? exactly.
So
yeah. So, and also, by the way, with the rise of mobile, to your point, because a lot of the mobile games are free-to-play games,
yeah,
right?
Right.
And there's a belief that for free-to-play game, it tends to be winner takes a lot, right? You know, you either get a blowout hit, or you're sort of like in the middle, or it doesn't work, right? You know, because
right.
It's a very competitive market for you in the mobile space, that it actually fits equity financing quite well. Because equity financing is, I would assume a lot of company would like fail, but as long as a couple of those become successful, I can make my return. If you imagine people who have invested in Supercell early days, XL Partners, London Venture Partners,
yeah,
they made quite a bit of return. London Partner Project probably made close to like, you know, 50x to 100x return on the investment, right? So for free-to-play, like mobile, very competitive space, it sort of makes sense sometimes to give them equity financing. Now, reversely, for project financing, you cannot suffer a lot of failures. If you go out and start investing in project financing as an investor, let's say, or publisher, if you do 10 project financing deal and half of them doesn't even come out the door,
right,
you're going to get fired, right? You know,
I think it's a scale and a timing problem,
yeah,
too. Like, you make an investment in the console. If you're developing a console studio and you're investing in it with equity, you're lucky to make a game once every 3 years.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you got one shot in a hit-driven industry, and all your money is gone. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you invest in a mobile studio back in the early days of mobile,
yeah,
you're investing in a company that could make 5 games
in
the same time period, and so they have more lottery tickets.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? So it depends on the timing a little bit too, so I guess that's true. I wonder, have any one of you in the audience kind of pitched to a publisher or investor before? How many of you have pitched before?
Good.
Okay.
A little pitch experience out there.
Yeah? How do you like your experience pitching? Was it successful or not?
Yeah.
It's successful. That's very nice. Was it a mobile or PC game? Oh, you make tools, okay. And you pitched and you got money from equity, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Any developer as well out there who pitched to a publisher? Was it successful? Yeah. And you're making a mobile or PC game?
PC console.
PC console. And you pitched to a traditional publisher?
I would say so,
yeah. Yeah, okay. And it worked out. Do you like the deal?
Don't put him on the spot.
Yeah.
Who
put him
is
on the
publisher? I do. What is the deal?
I know, right? You know, he's not on camera, so it's okay.
It's okay.
No one can see him. Do you? You know, I love to, like, everyone is eating and whatnot. You know, I can have like a lot of questions. I'd rather like open up and say, like, what are some of your burning question day to day as a developer? You must have a lot of burning questions. Who doesn't have a burning question in their mind? You know, every week. Okay, everyone has some. So why don't you share with us some of your burning question today? Existential question, you know, where do I wash my laundry? And all that kind of questions. Yes.
For all of you guys, what's your average turnaround time from starting a conversation, like typical turnaround time from starting a conversation to closing a deal?
Great. The question is, what's our average turnaround time from liking a deal to closing a deal or starting a conversation? You want to start, Alex?
Yeah, so the last three titles that we signed took anywhere between 17 and 26 days from first meeting to signing.
And talk about term sheet or you talk about long form?
Long form.
Yeah.
So first discussion, meeting with the team, and like.
Yeah. So the reason why Alexi and I started Calendlite, it's now objective principle is to sign something as quickly as we can. And we don't want to delay or drag people out. And so I think we've been doing it very successfully, right? You know, 2-3 week process.
Yeah, I don't think that's normal.
It's very, yeah. I remember seeing a chart of like the 6 month M&A, but that's for M&A.
That's M&A. Yeah. I mean, investment is a shorter time frame, but yeah, usually like if you're getting a financial investor, they can move pretty quickly. If you're getting a strategic, usually that money's coming from a larger organization that is driven by some form of bureaucracy and controls and approval systems, and this takes time. Yeah. Plus there's a big legal group, and so when you add all that in, it's not unusual for something to take 3 months.
Yeah. How long would it take to...
For us, it depends on the deal, on the structure of the company. It can take from 2 weeks to 6 months. Of course, yes, equity deal require due diligence and a lot of other stuff.
Yeah.
But because we more or less understand the developers, if they already signed like binding term sheet, long form for us it's like technical work. And if we prepare for the deal, we can close the deal for developer like in 2 weeks, they start receiving money. And of course sometimes needed to most developers in worldwide need to reorganizations, prepare for like any like equity investment and so on. Sometimes it's not by us. It's because developer needs to reorganize the structure to be more like clear for like big.
Right. That makes sense. My experience helping a lot, and I'm sure you have. I'm just looking at all the developers that have helped either project financing or equity. I think the average, the range is very high. It could go from 1 month, probably 2 weeks is actually on the very, very fast side, right? To long form. I'd say like at least 6 weeks is what you, at least 6 weeks, right? Because if you're dealing with any like larger organization, just getting to the long form would take you like 6 weeks, right? You know, 4 to 6 weeks. So at least minimum of 6 to 8 weeks. On average, you know, 3 months to 4 months, you know, or 2 to 3 to 4 months, depending on how you define the first starting point, of course, and how aggressively you pursue it. But I have seen deals that takes 9 months to close on the long side, you know. Yeah, which is a painful process, by the way, when it's taking like 6 to 9 months. Anything that drags out for 5-6 months become painful, actually, right, in general.
Agreed.
Yeah. But you know, some of the deals we're talking about could be like $80 million to $150 million deals, right? And those will take half a year to a year to close. Right?
But it depends when you're getting the investment. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
So
right.
If you're getting seed investment, there's less to check out on the diligence side.
Yeah.
A lot of times you don't have a lot going in.
Yeah, exactly.
Versus, you know, if you're looking for something that really kind of expands.
More substantial, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Then you're getting a lot in due diligence, and they're looking at the business, and they're looking at all your existing contracts and liabilities.
Yeah.
It's like it takes a long time.
By the way, I'll follow up that question with another question. What's our advice to speed up the process? Like if you're locking a contract, negotiating with an M&A or an investment or publishing deal or whatnot down the road, what can developers or smaller site do to actually make sure that it's proceeding as quickly as it can, right? You know, any advice from your side?
Absolutely. I mean, well, there's quite a lot. I mean, you'd be surprised how many studios don't have any good financial reporting. They do their own bookkeeping, they're checkbook driven, they don't have anything that's laid out in the way of a P&L, a balance sheet, cash flow statement. These are just obviously basically stuff that you need to provide, and you need to provide it from a reliable third-party source that knows accounting.
Yeah, but how many of you have a third-party accountant on the books that...
Doesn't have to be KPMG, doesn't have to be huge, but
it has to be reputable. We've got one, we've got two, we've got three.
Right.
Wow.
But this is part of being prepared for investment in the future or acquisition in the future. It's not going to happen until all your data is together. And also, you need an organized system to keep track of all of your contracts, all the debt, any liabilities that you have. You need to have that in one place and organized. So you'd be surprised how many people are like, oh, yeah, I saw that around here somewhere.
Yeah.
Right? That really doesn't work well when you're trying to get money.
How many of you don't have all your company contracts in one single place, one single locker? Don't have it on one. Yeah, there are a couple of it. Don't be ashamed. Don't be shy, you know?
It's okay. We can't. No one can see you.
No one can see you. Exactly. I can't see you because the bright lights in my eyes right now. You know. Well, any thoughts from your side? How do you speed up the process? What are the fastest deals?
Don't expect the developers on the seed stage or A stage can be prepared to the investments. We, from our side, prepare at least of documents that they need to prepare.
Yeah.
We try to sign all terms in term sheet.
Yeah.
And in this case, yes, we can support studio after it to prepare all documents, go through the due diligence.
Yeah.
And frankly, because a lot of developers on the early stage, because the deal time frame depends on the size of the deal.
Of course.
Discussion about like 300,000-500,000, we can organize through the loan agreement, convertible loan, and some other stuff.
Very quickly, right?
And wait until the company reorganized to be fitted to our requirements.
Absolutely.
But yes, if we sign like term sheet or a convertible loan, we can help the company and reorganize business in the right way. Because sometimes in my personal opinion, much more easier to reorganize business from scratch than to try to clean everything in the current company.
Yeah.
And if it's not a big business, on like early stages, it's easily to reorganize. And in this case, we don't ask to company to be prepared for due diligence.
Of course.
If we talk about like big deals, like from like several million or more, of course, it's a question about reorganization. Sometimes it can be difficult, depends on the IP rights, who hold the old IP rights.
Yeah.
It's also a big issue for developers, not only about accounting. The biggest issue for developers, nobody cares about how to organize IP rights. Because it's not only a question about the name of the game.
Oh, yeah.
It's also a question about your labor agreements between company and employments, outsourcers, and some other stuff. And you need to concentrate all IP rights in one place.
Yeah, in one entity, yes.
And nobody cared about it before, I don't know, achieve like several million revenue in a month. I know a lot of big companies that also doesn't care about how to sign all agreements with all employments, about like all artists, game designers, coders. This is the biggest issue, I think.
We should talk more about that. Interesting.
Point.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Could we also say that... Could you go into some explanation of what you mean by convertible and how the mechanics of that work?
It's like classical convertible loan. We can give, for example, on the seed stage, if we don't want to wait and the company organized in the right way, we can give like convertible loan based on some principle, the future valuation, and company can return for us, for example, loan before we execute, for example, some options to for the acquisition, or it can be converted on the future valuation.
Yeah.
On any liquidity events.
So
frankly, it's more or less standard like convertible loan.
So just a simple, I mean, if you ever think about equity financing in future, when your company is still small, there's a time when it's faster to get a loan directly, and what they call convertible loan is essentially they're borrowing you the money on paper, but that money will be converted into equity when you have a price. So, you know, normally I would invest $1 million for a 10% share at the valuation of $10 million, right, for example. But instead of that, I'm going to say, I'm going to give you $1 million as a loan, right? And that $1 million will convert into equity when you have a price. So if you someone start investing in you at a $15 million valuation, that $1 million loan I gave you become, you know, number of shares, right? It's called convertible debt or convertible loan, and it's very commonly used for smaller companies and startups. I have an advice, but I'll let Alexey talk about it too. Any thoughts on how you can speed up the process?
I would say if you're in discussion with someone, get help on the legal side, on the accounting side, and get people who understand our industry. I think I've had a lot of discussions where the counterpart was maybe a lawyer that didn't really understand games and didn't understand how things were practiced in the industry. Even just accountants who just didn't understand how to handle gaming tax credits, loans, and just, I think it's good if you can't find someone to support you when you get to do an investment, also get somebody with banking experience but who understands the industry. I think that's critical.
Yeah.
And that typically slows down the process quite a bit because you end up discussing provisions that are understood by everybody, but that this person on the other side may not understand and may insist and drag out the process.
Yeah. And also because he's trying to add value when where he doesn't really understand.
Yeah, I think Maker Fund invests in a lot of early stage companies as well. So a lot of the company we invest in have nothing but a business plan or a prototype or, you know, maybe a couple of sheets of paper. Same thing, not much to look at. What we find helpful and what can help us speed up our process, and you know, I think if you future talk to any publisher or whatnot or investors, first you kind of need to understand a little bit of where they come from as well. You know, do some research around what they are looking for. I think that's important to see whether, you know, what you want to do fits what they want as well. Secondly, I think depending on who you talk to, like if you're talking to, for example, us or Alexey, like being open and upfront and proactive is important. Proactive in terms of communication as well, because sometimes we are loaded with other sort of deals and we're busy, right, as investors sometimes. And you guys are busy, everyone's busy. And sometimes it's not in the priority list and you may need to kind of bump it up a little bit if they don't get back to you on time. Have a clarity. Give them, put it on their plate to say, what is your timeline and what are exactly your processes that needs to make the decision? Because a lot of time in larger organization, when you're talking to a business development person or whatnot, they may not be the person that makes the decision. A lot of times they are actually just taking information into a larger decision group or a committee where they would then collectively make the decision. So understanding that process is also quite important because you would want to know, you know, who are the stakeholders, how long does it take to get there, what kind of information is needed for that decision to be made. It's actually quite interesting. Of all the company we've talked to, there are only a couple, I say less than 20% of founders would ask me, like, what exactly is your process and what's the timeline on your side, right? And when they ask the question, it's smart, right? Because then I have to tell them, you know, we've got a decision process maybe every 2 weeks. You know, it's just me and this person making this decision. We need these kind of data to make it, right? A lot of time founders just give everything and say, you know, I'll just wait for you to hear back. They feel like, I guess that comes from the fact that because they feel like they're in a lesser position because they're trying to get money, that they don't want to, like, you know, push too hard, right? But I don't think that's the case. I feel like if you're engaging with someone, whether it's a publisher or investor, you have the right to know also what's really going on, right? You know, because I don't think we do that, but investors and publishers, they give you the dance around a lot. I don't know if you have had that. And the dance around means they don't really have conviction or maybe they're too busy or they're not sure, right? A lot of times, you know, honestly, we're not sure too, and I understand that. But they, you know, they're invested in this world. When they're not sure, they don't directly go back and say no, and they just put it on the back burner. And that's actually a pretty bad practice. But what happens is, like, you're just sitting there waiting for it to happen, not sharing what's going on. But the person, the counterpart, is, like, forgotten about you already, right? So I think being proactive to make sure you don't get to dance around too much is actually quite important, you know, in this process. I don't know if it's helpful.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Any other burning questions you guys have?
Can I ask one thing then?
Yeah, yeah.
And tell me what you think. So in terms of company organization, LLC versus C Corp, S Corp, do you have thoughts on that, just on your fund, what you're looking for?
If you're
seeking investment from you, would you expect them to already be a C Corp?
Yeah, we cannot invest in LLC due to a lot of, like, tax issue and all that. We could go into a lot of detail. But typically we need them to set up as a C Corp or S Corp, but not LLC to invest in them, right?
So, right. Yeah.
I don't know how many in the audience actually know what the structure is and how.
If they set up the company, right?
But a lot of them may not be the ones who set up the company, right?
I think in general, if you're just starting out, you're probably going to go with the easiest form of organization. You're going to adapt to an LLC. And if you're seeking angel investors, they as individuals may actually prefer the LLC as a form of investment. But then once you get to the professional investors, they're going to ask you for shares and equity, and that's going to flip you over to a C corp pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think it's a one-time thing you have to do, right?
Right.
You know, if you do want to start taking investment from professional organizations, it's very typical that they ask you to switch over. It's a one-time cost, and you know you get it done with, and then you know, there you go, right?
Yes, you know? This is true, but it has implications for how you run your business.
Of course,
and. Right? Whether you have a board or not, whether you have meeting notes or not, some are required by law.
Yeah, to have all the minutes and all that, yeah.
But it's mostly for U.S. if I correct me, it's good market. Yeah, because for European market, LLC form, it's okay for investors. It's not a big issue.
It's U.S., yes. We're talking about U.S.
We're talking about U.S.,
yeah. Any burning questions from the audience? Yes, burning questions. There's a couple of hands, but sorry, we'll get back to you.
So, what are the red flags and deal breakers for you?
Wow. Hey, Alexi.
That's good.
That's a great question, by the way.
Awesome question.
Oh, man. Hey, Alexi, do you want to start? You know, red flags. Wow, man. Oh, man, so sensitive. The question is, what is a red flag or a deal breaker from an investment side? Like, what do you see to say, oh, my God, I'm not going to touch this, right? You know? I'm just buying time.
So this applies to us. We really decide based on how passionate we are about a project. That's really the number one thing for us. So even if we see things that we don't like, provided that we feel like we can remedy them, we'll try to come up with solutions. So there's a team that we're looking at, just an example, that isn't really good on the back end and networking. We're going to try to pair them with someone to help resolve. Normally, that could be a deal breaker because their game is online and connected, and, well, that's problematic. The things that really probably would be a deal breaker for us is just if we feel like the founders are not honest with us and not telling us what's going on.
That's another one.
If we ask for an assessment of the issues that we've seen in the game and that needs to be corrected, and the assessment is incorrect, whether you know, accidentally incorrect, that's a problem, but if it's willfully incorrect, that's also an issue. But I would say, at least for us, is transparency and honesty is kind of the number one thing. If we feel like, even if we see issues that would normally maybe tell us, hey, you know what, we should move up with this project, I think we're okay spending more time with the team, helping them get to a good place and sort of evolve through the process. But if we feel like the founders are not truthful, then that's an immediate stop to the conversation.
Yeah. What about you, Elia? Any red flags?
Yes, the main question is, it's about trust.
Yeah.
This is the main point for a deal breaker. Yeah. Now, it's very difficult to check because before deal, you can trust, but the biggest issue about trust after the deal. If you talk about like deal structure, sometimes can be deal breaker if the founders choose some like specific region for us.
Yeah.
And if
choose some specific agency, is that?
Region, for example, for registration. It's also, if a US company, yes, you mostly registered in the US, but if you talk with European or Asia like companies, sometimes founders decide afraid European, like Cyprus, Malta, or some like countries don't want to go to this direction. In this case, yes, for us it can be deal breaker sometimes, because we prefer to use like English law, and in this case we need to make the deal in some specific regions where the English law work well.
Yeah,
we cannot make deal, for example, we doesn't want to make deals frankly in like Hong Kong or in Singapore, because sometimes it's very difficult.
Yeah.
For the global companies, and in this case, yes, we require our requirements move the holding company to some regions suitable for us.
Yeah.
It's like second deal breaker after trust. Trust, that's very difficult to check before the deal.
Yeah.
This is the biggest issue. Of course, first of all, we try to check founders. I don't know how to say in English, try to understand, do we have some like, I don't know.
Chemistry,
yeah. Yes, yeah. Relationships can be, you know, can be like well in the future or not, because like I'm already told, we prefer to invest like in the partners because we acquire no than 51%, no more.
Yeah.
And in this case, we need to live with the founders next like, I don't know, 20 years. It's like marriage. It's very difficult. It's very easy to merge, but very difficult to split.
Yeah.
This is the issue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What about?
In terms of what I see out there, I think one is an incomplete founding team, because then you don't really know what you're investing in.
Yeah, absolutely.
And even if you know you are well credited, so there's really the fundamental. If there's someone who is extremely well known in the industry and he's going out for funding, like his pool of potential places to go opens up tremendously. Yeah, you can actually go to a traditional angel, or you can go to a traditional VC as well, and some of those places will look at you. But if you believe that this person is well connected and well respected, that they're going to be able to build a founding team, that's great, but there's still quite a degree of risk there.
Yeah.
Like, you want to know who you're investing in as a fully founded team. So that's one. And another is, I think, not really having a good idea of the space that you're trying to go into, not having a hypothesis about what kind of studio you're going to be.
Yeah.
Some studios are more of the scattershot approach. Like, I've got five pitches.
Yeah, that's bad.
Which
that's
is bad because you don't believe in anything, really.
Yeah.
You'd rather see someone that's got conviction and passion to chase one particular direction.
Yeah. So I'm going to add three more things, but all of you, what you said is really right. And to your point, though, very interestingly, absolutely, when a founder has like five directions going, that's something that we immediately shy away from. If they can lay it out in terms of a 1, 2, 3 step of how they want to involve the company, fine. But if they want to pursue like more than 2, 3 directions at the same time, it's already a big red flag. I'm not saying that it's a complete no right away, but it's typically something that we avoid already. But to that point though, Makers actually, in the last 1 year of existence, I've personally seen about 800 deals now. A lot of them we didn't deep dive, right? About 400 went deeper, about 150 we really went deep. There's one thing about founder quality, and it comes back to a little bit around trust, but also like this person. So first of all, you want a founder to be, of course, convicted of what he's trying to do and really want to show conviction and want to go at it, right? Want to do it and change the world. Mm-hmm. You'd be surprised though when you pitch an idea or when you pitch whether it's a company idea or a game idea, how many of that already had an investor or publisher have seen similar things already? Because, you know, from your scale, you work on this thing or 1, 2, 3 big ideas and it's, you know, taking up a lot of your time and thinking. From our side, because we see a lot of momentum, we do see a lot of similar things. And each of them are a little different, of course, and everyone's unique, but something that's similar. And here comes the thing. When there are a founder that comes in, and this is maybe it's only my thing, I don't know if it's true for you, mm-hmm. when he's overly convicted of something and don't ground it on reality, i.e. when I ask you what are your fears and what are your weaknesses or who do you think your competitors are, and they give you this runabout answer where, you know, we don't really have a competitor or whatnot, you know, and, you know, what if like, oh, big companies come in and do this or whatever, and they give you a completely kind of runabout and say, oh, you don't have to worry about that. That's when I start to worry, right? Because I prefer them to actually give me an honest answer, right? Because either when you say that, either you haven't thought through it or you're just so blindly believing
in
your idea. Yeah, that actually, that scares me, right? Because you're either too arrogant or you're overconfident about something, right? Because who knows, right? Everything can happen, right? You know, when we actually invest in venture, I would assume that a lot of company may fail. It's okay it fails, right? You know, but we learn from it and grow from it. So that's one red flag. The red flag is a overconfident founder that doesn't see it, you know, has a blind spot on all its weaknesses, right? You know, so that's one. Other two like minor like logistical sort of like if you guys are founders someday and you know want to grow a company, a couple of things to be careful of. One is cap table. If the cap table is messed up, it's very hard to invest. So cap table is your investor table, right? Now you have maybe 100% share, maybe it's shared between 50-50 with your founder, co-founder, or whatnot. For venture investing to come in, you have to have a cleaner cap table, i.e. the founder needs to still own enough share for us to buy into it. If there's a company that already has another company that's, you know, with 80% control and the founder only has 20%, you will never be able to raise money into it, right?
This is your earlier point when we discussed.
That's why equity financing is something that if you don't have experience, you do need to seek help, right? Because I have seen a couple of companies, one San Francisco-based company in VR recently that has exactly the same issue where they grow really quickly, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone wants to invest in them, but the investor has more than like 60%, 70% share, right? No one can invest in it anymore because it's already, when you actually have 70% share that's owned by one other company, you're, without you knowing it, you're a subsidiary of that company, right? you know, in some ways, right? Because they own you 70%. So that's something that we need to be very careful. The second thing when we invest in like early, especially early stage company or maybe growth stage, is that they have a lot of contract that ties them down. Because if I want to invest in your idea, I was hoping that you can grow, right? You know, and if there's a lot of restrictive contract that you have already signed with strategics or whatnot, if you're making a game, the rights already, the Asia rights already given to a certain player or Europe or whatnot, then it makes it hard, that much harder for us to actually invest, because we do not believe you have the ultimate freedom, degree of freedom to do whatever you want, you know, when the opportunity comes. So that's another thing I would urge like early founders to think through when you're gonna give away rights to your game or certain thing you're making, that this will down the road may affect your investment opportunity, right, from the outside, yeah.
You know, your point that you raised about what it's like from this side of the table,
yeah,
is it's a valid one, right? Because anyone who is in the deal making side who sees a lot of deal flow, and when I was in BizDev and Alexi was in BizDev, like we saw a lot of pitches. The great thing is there's this seasonality, there's this kind of zeitgeist that happens, right?
Yes, yes.
And like, you know, I can point to the times that we saw a lot of parkour in games, and we just knew, oh, someone's gonna make like a big parkour game.
Yeah, Battle Royale last year.
Right, and then about 6 years ago, we started seeing a ton of pitches that were kind of precursors to Battle Royale,
yeah.
And we just knew. And so we knew from this deal flow that there's gonna be one or two really successful games with this idea.
Yeah.
And then we're just kind of picking between all of you guys that pitched that.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and then we just kind of put our bets on the most reliable horse to us.
Mm-hmm.
So bear in mind that you know you guys do have unique vision and ideas, but it's actually all in a zeitgeist. You're kind of in a current with a bunch of other people that have a similar idea at the same time.
We're all sheeps.
No, but it's all popular culture, yeah, and get fed by you know the media and movies and so forth and books.
Yeah.
And so that's why things happen like that.
Yeah.
But just know that you're running alongside a bunch of people that are probably pitching similar things to you, and you have to make yourself look like
absolutely.
The best.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. I'm sorry, yes?
So what stage are you guys going to invest in, and how much do you invest in?
Makers Fund? Makers Fund is very simple. We do a Series A. So typically, you would have your first round. If you ever raise equity, your first round money come in typically comes from your friends and family or yourself, right? You know, just get it going, right? You know, these are typically anywhere from, you know, less than $500,000, right? Maybe, you know, 50K to 100K, 200K, you know, just to get the horse going. Then your first round, we call it Series A for people who are not familiar with the jargon. Series A is when you actually go out and raise a bigger round, and usually from an institutional investor, so either from a fund or someone. And those rounds usually, you know, it can vary a lot, but typical Series A, and correct me if like, everyone has a different view on it, but our Series A is typically anywhere from investing between $1 to $5 million. So we've gone up to 6-7 as well, but it's typically within that range with a valuation of about like anywhere from 15 to 20-ish kind of valuation. So we're taking about 10% share. If we invest in 2 million at 10% share, it's like 20 million, you know, or 3 at 20. So that's the range that we invest in. And in fact, I'm not to discourage people here. The gaming industry, by the way, if you look at all the investment in this space, Series A, in fact, your first institutional money in, is the toughest. It's by far the most difficult because there's enough angel investor, there's enough friends and uncles that can help you get your business going. But your first round where you're getting a professional investor in, gaming as an industry has been misunderstood for many, many years. And I feel like everyone in this room should know that very well, right? You know, I think we're finally getting to a stage in the West where, you know, more and more professional investors start to look at us and say, there's something here, but I still don't get it, right? You know? And so we're not like Silicon Valley. In Silicon Valley, you can go raise Series A pretty quickly, right? You know, there's something unfair about the industry, by the way, and I can talk on and on, but I'm not gonna skip all of that. When some company become more successful in the gaming business, actually when you go and raise growth rounds, which is after your Series A or early B, where your company is showing traction already, there's plenty of investors who want to do that.
Like regular old investors.
So if you think about like crossing the bridge to somewhere, the glorious future, you have this like chunk of bridge called Series A, where it's like the Death Valley, right? You know, everyone just sleep down here. And in fact, the reason why I actually started Makers Fund is because, you know, when I was at McKinsey, helping all these developers, seeing them just like plunge into this gap, there must be a way we could do something about it, right? You know, and this includes proving that there's way to invest in it to generate returns. So more people from outside the industry will put money in it as well, right? You know, so the fund, you know, Maker as a result actually sticks right in that bridge area. Now, we're a small fund, so it's actually hard to still like make an impact. But the idea for the fund is to prove that the model works, and ideally in the next 3 to 5 years, you know, inspire other people to create these funds. So there's a lot of Makers Fund out there that would do the same thing, right, for the industry. But you know, to your point, yeah, that's where we invest in. The most critical part, I feel like, today.
So for Makers Fund,
yes.
If I can ask you and play moderator for a second.
Please.
So what do you expect a studio who is pitching you for an A round to have by that point versus a seed investment to have developed and have for you?
The reason I have to answer this question in tandem with what we're doing with Kowloon as well.
Yeah.
Equity into content is still a tough choice because the reason is we have to see the company exit or sell to actually see the end of the day. That's just by nature how equity fund works, right? Unfortunately, right? Mm-hmm. Especially if you're an independent equity fund. So at Series A, to have the conviction that this company is going to exit in, you know, if not in 5 years, maybe in 10 years, is a pretty high bar, just right. To be clear, right? You know, so typically, we do have to look at, if it's in the content space, they need to have one very experienced founder that we know that they can deliver. They have delivered games before, and they know what they're talking about. Very unique vision, and that is very distinct and separate from what we see in general. And three, a vision into the 3 to 5 year future, maybe even 2 to 3 year future, where I have a unique insight about something that I know I can chase it, and this is why I can get it, right? So a very star-studded team with a good track record that exactly knows where, you know, where the market is going and has a very unique vision to deliver it. So it's actually not an easy part. So flip side, we talk a little bit about the reason why we set up Kowloon in tandem, right, to your point, is because there are many teams out there that, and honestly, I feel like guys, you know, even in the audience, a lot of you guys want to make games. You may not want to sell the company, right? This is not something you came in the game industry for, right? You know, if you're in China, maybe you want to sell because everyone is so short term. But in the US, in the West, no, right? You know, you want to make a game because you're passionate about gaming. We all came in there because we're passionate about it. And so you may not want to deal with like all this like investment bullshit, right? You know? And so investment in the company bullshit. Sorry, I'm being more and more exact. But so the reason why we set up Kowloon Nights is to say there are some awesome creators out there that doesn't care about company. I don't want to sell my company, but I've got this awesome game. We can actually provide project financing to them on a recoup model, so I don't lose money. If the game does well, we can actually make some money back and call it a day, right? You know, and not have to worry about whether the company is sellable or not in 10 years. So that's actually working very well in tandem right now.
The way we look at it is almost, I would say, the opposed approach, but we're very product driven. We look at a game, and if we felt that it's something special, almost irrespective of the team, that's what's going to drive our decision. And I think our belief is success can come from anywhere, and there's amazing creators who may not be great founders,
yeah,
and
exactly.
May not have the story to tell in like the 3-5 year vision. And so we almost try to
do the other way.
Everything and
yes.
Say, we're going to look at the product, we're going to look at what's in front of us, and if we believe in it, then we're going to fund it. And I think that's kind of very complementary in a way.
Yeah.
And I think our approach, you know, is going to, we also hope that there's going to be more Kowloon long term.
Yes.
I think that's
yes.
kind of the intent. If our model works, we want to see more people doing project financing and offering that as an option to developers. I think that's really important for the industry.
Yeah. So any thoughts? Sorry, I'm sorry.
Basically, we use another way of the investments. Frankly, we understand the game industry, it's not like IT business, and it's really difficult for classical venture fund. Because if we talk about like game business, in general, if a company more or less successful, it's like evergreen business. Then the companies generate like cash positive P&L, cash flow, and more or less it's okay.
Yeah.
And like you said, yes, the founders come to the game industry to make the game. They don't want to sell the company.
Yeah.
They want to sell the game and some other stuff.
Yeah.
And in this case, we try to create another way of investments. We invest only in game development on different stages and give the money to the funders only if in the start, for like cash-in, to support only game development process. We provide tools, assets, additional marketing support, and some other stuff. Only in this case, we invest in a company.
Yeah.
if the developer requires not only the money, but requirements, some additional like stuff which we can provide. And in this case, initially we invest like cash in the company.
Yeah.
Different stage from C to B, C if we try to compare with classical venture funds. And doesn't take more than 20%. It doesn't matter the valuation of the company on the early stage.
Yeah.
Because exchange on this, like for our opinion, very good terms, we ask the company to take the option to acquire like additional, like up to 51%.
Yeah.
This is the main our difference. And in this case, yes, we take the options. We doesn't fix the price for the option. We ready to satisfy market valuation in the future based on the multiple to EBITDA or to revenue. It doesn't matter for us. Because if we talk, if you, no, if developer talk with the public company, our main business is to increase cost of our shares on the market. And if they acquire high growing, fast growing, like middle growing developer, it's good for us. We don't need to resell the company in the future. We want to take the like financial consolidation. And in this case, we give to developer totally creative freedom.
Yeah.
We write an SHA for the developer. We cannot push developer in any way.
Okay.
We take only financial consolidation. And this way, we try to find like partnership investment deal, I name it, in this direction.
Yeah.
Because developers still have creative freedom. It's written in SHA. We don't take operation control on the studio. It's also written in SHA. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We take only financial consolidation, and we provide.
By the way, so you invest about 20% or no more than 20%?
Initially, we invest 20%. Like doesn't matter the valuation. Yeah.
But they ultimately want to go to 50%, 51%.
We want to have the right
option,
right? Because you know, if you're as a listed entity, you do want to consolidate, right? Ultimately, right? That's part of the drive, no?
Yeah, no. If we take like 20%, we don't consolidate. If we company achieve some numbers, interesting for us, we.
I'm just curious what the model is, that's all. Yeah. You know, I work with a lot of A-share company back in the days, when you were talking about back in the crazy days in China. You know, they don't care about control as well. They put money in, we have a listco. You know, if I can consolidate when you can make money, it's good for everybody, right?
And, yeah, you know. No. We take the control because we need to see the company.
I see.
For us, it's we protect us from like, we cash in the company. Okay. Cash out, they can take only then we execute the option.
Yeah.
And only in this case, the founders can take some money from us.
Okay.
In other way, we invest only in the business.
Okay.
That's
all. Okay, cool. Well,
we try to find like balance between like freedom, investments, equity, project financing, some other stuff.
Interesting. Any thoughts?
I mean, yeah. So the thoughts I would have, if I'm advising a developer client, you know, my standard line on any sort of investment is to try to procure for yourself as much independence and autonomy as you can. Mm-hmm. And that means, you know, never at any point being unable to control your own fate for someone else who can then obtain majority control. Mm. And so this is not an attack on anyone up here, but just to say that, you know, from a developer's viewpoint, one of the most important things you can have is your autonomy. And for the final act where you give up your majority, your control over your company, I usually tell my clients, you know, there's only one price for 51% versus 100%. Mm-hmm. And it's to say, hey, you can buy 51% of my company for 100% of the price, or you can buy 100% of my company for 100% of the price. Which do you want? Largely because sometimes you get yourself into a position where you are now you're in the back seat of a vehicle that you used to drive, and you have no mechanism by which to get your investor to buy the rest. So that becomes a problematic industry. So what's your choice? Well, you know, maybe I should just leave, right? But you're leaving money on the table too.
Yeah.
So that's the thing, you know. I mean, there are so many issues with investment leading to acquisition that you really have to be comfortable with.
Yeah, I agree. And in this case, why we try to find like partnership deal, yes, we try to write in agreements initially. If we need it, we can acquire like up to 100%.
Right.
But when we start negotiation, we told we want to work with the team next like 5-10 years. If it's not interesting to founders that doesn't work with us. Yeah. If you're ready to work with us like 10 years, we write like operation control. Yes, we take like 51%, but we cannot change the CEO, or it doesn't take any operation control in the company or a creativity control. If you want our support, because for example, we find way not to dilute investor founders from the marketing money. We invest only in development. Marketing money, we provide like marketing share agreement without any interest from our side to support founders, to protect them from dilution from marketing money, for example, on the mobile platform.
Sure.
Because on mobile, for mobile studios, sometimes studios ask like $10 million investments. But really, for the game development, it's need like $1 million. Mm-hmm. All other money, it's only for the marketing. And it's different deal. Yeah. Yes, of course, for us, if developer work with us, we require less. Yes,
yeah, sure. I think the audience have other questions. Maybe we can move on.
I think we can move on, yeah.
Yeah. I see a couple more hands. Like, feel free to ask other questions. What are the burning questions you have?
Just shout it out.
Yes, or wow, so many. Yes.
So you guys are investors looking for safe investments. What are the structures in place for investing in experimental games? Yesterday, the LA Game Space published their closing announcement saying that they just did not have investment from places, where even though they had success and they had successful Kickstarter campaigns and everything else was there,
Yeah, never talked to them, so don't know them too well.
Sure.
Yeah.
But for experimental games.
Yeah. No, we invest. So venture investing from a fund's perspective, by nature, invests in experimental stuffs. When we say safe, we don't mean like 100%. Usually, it's founder coming out that have experience. So safe teams, but bold ideas. Because if they're investing in something, I don't think there's a thing as a safe game in the industry. Which, yeah.
There's no such thing as a safe
like,
game.
Unless you're like a Call of Duty or something, right? You know.
I don't want to talk about it super publicly, but like we support one and we just give them money in exchange for nothing. Just
yeah.
So
yeah. Oh, you talk about the one.
It's not a business model though.
It's not a business model. No, we get some interest rate on top, but it's okay.
Our investors are not here, so it's okay. But we believe in it. We think it's necessary. We also pick projects that are very experimental and different, and we.
Actually, if you look at Kowloon, someday you'll see some of our portfolio. I think it's going to come out, you know, pretty soon in next issues of certain magazine with some titles. And you'll see that, you know, project financing allow for a lot more experimentation, because if we believe there's a recoup model. Like, again, if you're combining a company investment that needs to exit at some point and experiment, then it becomes a little harder, right? Again, someone's raising their hands.
Someone's over there raising their hand.
Yeah,
tired.
For a while.
Yes.
Oh, you're trying to ask a question. I'm sorry. Oh, I thought he was stretching. I'm like,
No. He's asking a question.
He's
at the mic. Like, he's ready.
I was sitting in the back, and I didn't want to yell.
Oh, it's okay.
Please.
Because it's also weird. Now, then people can hear my questions. I had two. I lost my page. one was someone else brought up back there. When you talked about getting excellent middle management, about what size of a company would you look at for, would you see that being a good thing? And then the second was, you talk a lot about funding into studios that they're making things, but what about a work-for-hire service studio?
Yeah, good question.
And that's a kind of where there's maybe not any high-value IP, but there is the EBITDA, thank you, the proven ability, and maybe gunning for investment in like 1, 2, or 3 years.
Okay, so let's take that one by one then. Please stay there.
You can have a seat.
No, it's fine.
Do I have to keep my arm up?
No, you don't have to keep your arm up. All right, so hold it. First question was what?
Middle management.
What size
do you
put
in middle management?
Look, there's some inflection points in just all company organization. You know, there are the good old days when you're less than 10 and everybody consults each other about everything, right? It seems great. Then it's like the 15 person, like you're kind of a hyper-efficient team building smaller games. And you can still get away with your founders group. When you reach like about 30 people or so, you're getting at a scale where you can't all just communicate everything all the time and be a consensus-driven group. You need a leader. You need clear delineation, people who own certain parts of the business. As such, your founding group, if it's just two of you, you probably are too thin to take that on. And you're going to have to bring in someone that you can trust, but isn't necessarily your peer with the same amount of stock or any stock.
Yeah.
And that person's gonna, you know, whether it's they're running production or whether they're the CTO or what, you know, whatever they're doing, or the studio manager, whatever you call them, you know, they are mature, experienced lead types that are good at managing and dealing with people, that can solve problems and you know, in a creative and flexible way.
Yeah. Just to add to that point, small company actually, you know, because communication go in a network fashion, you know, it's a mesh, it's less important. But yeah, as you grow bigger, there's sort of like a rule of eight or whatnot. You could, there are many kind of rules like that. Is as one person, it's hard to manage more than a person. So if you're like a, if you're getting bigger and you have three founders and they all like, you all three talk very closely with each other, you can imagine like each of them can manage anywhere from 6 to 8 people. And so that's why usually when a studio gets 20 to 30 people, you're breaking that rule a little bit, right? Where someone is managing more than 10 people, and that just, you know, that just stretches the boundary beyond like what a person can do effectively, right? You know. So yeah, I agree, like around 30, 25
definitely
typically.
Definitely by 30. Yeah. And probably before, maybe again, 20, depends, right? How big the founding team is. Sometimes founding team is 5 very talented people.
Yeah, but the point here is also that you need to train them up, right?
That's
it
right.
Takes time to coach them and train them. If you're looking for it, and I'm going to hit 30 soon, I may want to bring in someone already so that they can, you know, start to pick up the pace as we actually grow there and not hit that number and say, shoot, I need a manager to scale now, but I now need to hire, and I'm running on a ship right now.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. See, it depends also, like, what it does is it gives you the option to take on a couple of different projects, if you will, or focus on different areas of the business to have that kind of middle management built in. And you're right, it takes time to train them and get them incorporated and part of the company and everything. But if you have that bandwidth, it allows you to do so much more.
Yeah, yeah. Some at one point also, these, you know, I think most of you may not have some of you are lucky enough to have a business partner that can run the business. A lot of you actually don't have the benefit of having a financial partner, by the way. I think most studios don't have a finance guy. At some point, you will need them. Not early, but as you grow, at some point, you need a bit of a more business-minded person. If you don't have that, it's usually come earlier. And then later down the road, if you have 30 people, you probably need to have one person that's like literally dedicated to, you know, bookkeeping and accounting and whatnot, right? I know those are the boring stuff, but it's actually quite critical, not just to raise money, but to actually run a business, you know? As you see people, a company with 20, 30 people making a lot of money, you know, don't have good bookkeeping, right? They don't really know where the money is at times.
And then your second question.
Oh, yeah, so if
work for hire. Yeah.
Looking at a work for hire service based studio that doesn't necessarily have any standout IP or high value IP, but it has sort of a bunch of the other things you were talking about when you're looking for the enterprise value.
Mm-hmm.
Like what?
So
what advice do you have for them?
What advice? You know, it's interesting. So it's strategic. So we have about 20 clients globally, and so that's our portfolio as we look at it. Bob and I often think about our portfolio in the way that a VC might think about their portfolio, or these guys might think about their portfolio. And some of it, for us, we invariably see talented studios who are what we would call stuck in a work-for-hire trap.
Yeah,
and often because they founded themselves right in the midst of the recession, or you know, and it was difficult to get funding or other work, and so what we try to do is we try to work with them to get them out of that trap, and sometimes it takes a while to do it. But the main point is this: you know, a creative studio makes its own IP. A work for hire studio is working for others. Sometimes they are creative and they develop IP that they subsequently give to whoever they're working for, but the best situation is if you actually are running a successful work for hire studio and you dedicate, and the margin that you're making, you dedicate to a team internally that only focuses on building your own owned IP in whatever that is. And that becomes the singular bet that your studio is making. So there's an engine that's producing margin, and that margin is going to feed a team that's creating new IP. And that hopefully can be your way out. And so that's basically the flywheel you're trying to start. But there's no great valuation. Nobody that I know in the industry will pay a great amount of money for capacity.
Yeah.
Capacity is worthless. Because capacity is everywhere.
Yeah.
Sometimes it happens if you can go not only for like work for hire, but if you try to create service company and not only do like porting or some just work for hire. If you start doing some customer support, service support in different way, like localization, customer support, quality assurance, some other stuff, you can create company like Keywords. And in this case, this company have very good valuation, sometimes much more bigger than like publishers. But it's a service company. It's also not work for hire, just work for hire.
Oh, okay, so
it's a good point, but it's also super unusual. And they went public to do it.
Keyword,
and it's not something in the United States, you're not going to go public with out here. But in Europe, you can do this thing. Yeah. And it is an interesting strategy. And in fact, I'm working with
But there's some others.
I'm working with a studio right now that is in a similar position and have similar ambitions. But in the United States, like, it's very difficult to scale up from where work for hire is, unless they work their way out.
I say work for hire, but I had been thinking service. So we do console ports, and we actually really like doing console ports.
You need not only port, you need to provide a lot of services. So then you need to create business, then publisher can call you every day for some small thoughts. Maybe not only port, maybe to test something, to localize something. You need to provide service, not just
If you're very good at ports, then another strategy could be that you take business into your own hands. Take the margin that you've made, and you go to a game that you think should be on another platform and say, hey, let me pay for that. Yeah. I'll pay you no minimum guarantee. We'll do the work, and we'll split the revenue 50-50. And then try to have passive income coming in, and then build from that. And we've seen that
there's I mean, 4J for Minecraft is a good
example.
Double 11 in the UK as well. So,
if we're doing that,
it's also good
what
message.
Would be the next step? If we're already doing that?
If you're already doing that, then are you successful at that?
Yeah, but it's small. So it's a small margin. We do a small project. We get a little bit more, and we're just sort of stair-stepping that up as we can.
You should come talk to me after this.
Good hope.
You did say stay up here.
No, good. Thank you for coming.
He means come up here. we're running out of time. Let's take one more question, and we'll... Yes, go ahead. We're still available here a little bit, so yeah.
So bringing up the work for hire, it's one of the things which I'm curious you guys as investors and looking at things is when someone gets into maybe our schedule you've already invested in or client that don't work for hire for a situation, let's say we're doing what you're doing, comes into IP conflict, not only with assets, but patentable code, things that they realize, oh wow, they did this for us, but we can get ahead of it because they're patents. How have you personally dealt with that? How do you look at that as studios or patent conflicts in general when you're starting to evaluate a studio because they're rising more and more these days, especially
patent
in
conflicts.
It's
common.
Like, sometimes it happens. Yes.
Are you talking about the specific like recent Montreal situation and stuff like that?
How do I prove to you that I did my due diligence thing, this is an honest mistake, or, you know, hey, we got to go protect this, we've got to go take it to them, they're trying to yank us. How do you look at that as investors?
As investors? We haven't really looked at investing in too much outsourcing studio anyways, because we're usually, so one advice is, we usually invest in founders that have started companies afresh, so, one thing is, you know, we have seen a lot of folks actually leaving larger companies or what they've done before to start something new, and that's where, you know, the experience count. As a venture investing, you're not investing in a company that has asset already necessarily. You're actually investing in people that can bring that skill set into something new, right? You know, so we typically look at a company that has not been founded for more than like 18 months to 2 years. So we haven't particularly run into that kind of situation. I don't know from a strategic perspective when they work with like a developer or an outsourced developer and then they get sued by, let's say, you know, one of the, you know, publisher that they work with. I don't know how they actually see that. You guys probably have a little bit more experience there, but
I mean, I can't say that I have encountered that sort of thing before. You know, to me, it really, you just have to resolve a case on its merits.
Yeah.
The most important thing is that these are like holes in a boat. You know what I mean? You got to do something about them or it's going to sink you eventually. It's really about, can you prove efficiently and effectively that any kind of patent conflict, that, you know, there was prior art on your side, that there was no way that this was, some sort of breach on your part, that you were just working in good faith and thought that you clearly had all rights or whatever. But let's say that it's not clear. And then the best thing you can do is try to find some sort of settlement as fast as you can, get this behind you, and move on.
Okay, so you look at that because I see a lot of broad concepts people fight over are starting to look at in gaming and looking at, hey, I own this. And I think for smaller developers, that's starting to look very scary because it's like, you know, not to get the horse, science will be, is that a concept?
I think it has to be something that's a lot more specific and easier to own than, you know, say, side scroller. Because everybody makes side scrollers. No one's been attacked.
As an investor, people do legal due diligence after signing term sheet. If there's material risk that you're going to get sued, then it does become a blemish, right? Because as an investor, you do worry, like, but it, I mean, if you're investing in a very well-known creator, right, and he left this like AAA publisher coming out, and they had a lawsuit and whatnot, now you're investing in him. I mean, you do, as an investor, you have to be responsible in thinking, like, what is the likelihood that, you know, they get sued in the end, and then this person will lose the lawsuit and have get into trouble, right? So that becomes something that becomes real. But what I'm trying to say is, it has to be fairly high profile, right? You know, because, you know, it's not like all the time publisher are trying to sue like really small developer or whatnot. They've got busier things to do, right? You know, typically.
Usually by the time.
Yeah. But
I do agree that like it's almost a signal of a good problem. Like you're only gonna get sued if you're actually successful. Yeah. Which means, you know, you're probably starting to get some money back. So that's good. Right?
That's true. That's true. Actually. Yeah.
Okay, well, unfortunately we've run out of time, but these guys will stay around for drinks and snacks later on, so please do the talk. Round of applause.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah.